Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, two very different views of the world from two very different kinds of personalities. Larry Elder on the right and Brian Tyler Cohen on the left. In a moment, we'll talk with Brian, who is a progressive podcaster listened to by millions of people. But we start with a Republican radio host listened to by millions of people. Larry Elder, who we've talked to as a panelist, as a guest, as a governor candidate, now running for president of the United States. Our first time talking to him as a presidential candidate on the show. We talked to him about that. We talked to him about his new book, about his recall race, which we covered so much here on the show. And we talked to him about his family and his views on race. So let's start with Larry Elder. Larry Elder has joined us in so many different roles here on The Issue Is before, but never as a presidential candidate. So let's put some info on the screen, which is the first thing he wants you to do. This is elderforpresident.com is his website where you can donate and find out more information about his presidential campaign. Larry also has a new book coming out available for pre-order right now called As Goes California, where he recounts his time running for governor and talks about the Golden State as a sort of cautionary tale to the nation. Larry Elder, welcome back to The Issue Is. Great to see you.
Thank you for having me, Alex. I appreciate it.
All right. So we have hinted for years on this show now about this concept that you would run for president. Now you've made it official. You decided to actually do it.
Right.
Why are you doing it?
You know, Alex, my father was in the military. He was a Marine vet. He was one of the first Black Marines. We're called the Montford Point Marines. He served on Guam during World War II. My older brother, Kirk, was in the Navy. He was a Vietnam-era vet. My little brother, Dennis, actually went to Vietnam in the Army. I'm the only one who didn't serve. And I've always felt bad about that. And I'm doing this, Alex, because I feel I need to give back to a country that's been so great to me and to my family. I would rather not spend my winters in Iowa. I'd rather not spend my winters in New Hampshire. But I feel I have a moral, a patriotic, and a spiritual obligation to give back to a country that's been so great to me. That's why I'm doing this.
And we've seen you out on the campaign trail. What's it like out there? What are you learning from the country?
Well, I've been spending a lot of time in Iowa. I've learned that at the Iowa State Fair, they have pork chop on a stick, bacon on a chick on a stick, butter on a stick, and I've learned that you can gain 10 pounds and not lose it over the course of a year. It's just been exhilarating, fun, hard, frustrating. The hard part is I've got to raise a lot of money. I've got to raise at least money from at least 40,000 individual donors. And in 20 states, you have to have 200 donors each. So it's daunting for somebody like me. And I'm not flush. I'm not Donald Trump. I'm not a multimillionaire tech guy. When I announce, my income suddenly goes to zero. And so it's a grind. But again, I'm doing it because I feel I have an obligation to do it.
All right, Larry. One question that I'm sure a lot of people are wondering is, you start this as an underdog.
Right.
You're running against Donald Trump. How do you beat him? What is the lane to victory for you?
Well, regarding me being an underdog, when Donald Trump announced, I think there was a poll that came out about 10 days later, and Jeb Bush was at 17%. He was at 12%, and you saw what happened. So things can change. Here's how I see it, Alex. Republicans are of two minds about 45. There are those who love him, and there are those who love what he did as president, but fear, for reasons that I believe are unfair to him, that a sufficient number of swing voters in suburban states would not vote for the man if he walked on water. In fact, if he did, they say he can't swim. Now, the question is, if you like the America First agenda, and I do, for the most part, virtually everything he did, I agree with, but you want a vehicle who has not turned off suburban women so that enough of them will vote for him in the swing states that will control this race, I'm your man.
So you're essentially saying you're Trumpism without Trump.
I would put it somewhat differently, but I've got no problem with that. The reason I say that is because I was referred to as a Trump Republican when I ran for governor. And I said, I'm a Republican. Am I supposed to vote for Joe Biden, for Hillary? You didn't call me a Mitt Romney Republican. You didn't call me a George W. Bush Republican. You didn't call me a George Herbert Walker Bush Republican. You call me a Trump Republican. Why? Because Trump turns off so many people. You brand somebody by calling them a Trump Republican, all of a sudden it's
Right. Mm-hmm. So even if he got the nominee, it sounds like you would be supportive of him.
I'm going to support whoever he or she is. That's one of our problems. As you know, when I ran for governor, I did not say a single negative thing about any of my rivals. Unfortunately, they did not return the favor, but I intend to adhere to that. The goal here, as when I ran for governor, is to topple Gavin Newsom. The goal here is to topple Biden-Harris. They have done incalculable damage to this country in the last 2.5 years, and we need to win.
You know, one of the big issues you talk about often that you want to bring to this is the idea of the importance of fathers.
Absolutely.
In America. Mm-hmm. You've also talked a lot about your dad. We've got mm-hmm. a picture of him. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, right. But you've written beautifully about him in the past. What do you think your dad would think of his son running for president?
He would be blown away. So would my mom. When I was 7 years old, Alex, I recall sitting down and we went through an illustrated book of all the presidents from George Washington to the incumbent Dwight Eisenhower. Went through every single one of them. And my mom closed the book and she said, Larry, someday if you want it badly enough, you can be in this book. Now, I never wanted to run for office. I thought she was crazy. Not that I couldn't do it, but that she thought that's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And here I am doing it. They both would be amazed. I gave a speech one time at the Ronald Reagan Library where I talked a little bit about my dad. As you know, he left home at the age of 13, never knew his biological father, which shows you it's not necessarily a death sentence, and ended up cleaning toilets until I was 10 years old, started a little cafe when he was 47 years old, which is 20 years longer than the average age at which somebody starts a business. Ran it until his early 80s. When he retired, he owned that property, the property next door to it, and the home that's still in our family. So my dad retired with a little less than $1 million. So I told a little bit about my dad, my mom. My mom grew up on a farm in Huntsville, Alabama. Both of them are from the Jim Crow South. And suddenly I was interrupted by a standing ovation because I mentioned my mom and my dad are actually here. And they stopped my speech. They stood up and they gave my parents a standing ovation. My speech is over, Alex. My first book had just come out, The 10 Things You Can't Say in America. And people were lining up behind my dad with pens in their hands. And my dad was signing my book at the Ronald Reagan Library. Only in America.
Wow. Mm-hmm. What a beautiful story. Let's talk a little bit more about the campaign. You just posted a comment that somebody else posted as a comment on right. your social media.
Right, right.
Let's put that up on the screen so people can read it. It says, even if Larry Elder doesn't win the presidency, what he will say on the campaign trail will be thought-provoking, and he most definitely should be a cabinet member. So what cabinet post would you like?
Well, I'm running for president. I'm not running right. to be vice president. I'm not running for a cabinet position. I'm running to do a number of things. Obviously, I was a supporter of Donald Trump. I supported his policies on borders, on taxes, on reducing regulations, on getting tough with China. But I also want to bring to the forefront the issue, as you pointed out earlier, of fatherlessness. 40% of all American kids now enter the world without a father in the home married to the mother. 70% in the black community. And Obama once said, a kid raised without a father is 5 times more likely to be poor and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, and 20 times more likely to end up in jail. Now, the question is, how have we gone from having 25% of black kids entering the world without a father in the home married to the mother in 1965 to 70% today? And I argue it's the welfare state. We've incentivized women to marry the government. We've incentivized men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility. The second issue is this lie that the Democrats keep promoting that America remains systemically racist. We all know that at one time it was, but it no longer is. This is a country that elected and reelected the first black president, the only majority white country to ever do so. If black America were a separate country, its gross GDP would make it the 15th or 16th largest country in the world. As we speak, the mayors of America's 3 largest cities, New York, LA, Chicago, are all black. We just had a contest between 2 black men running for Senate in a deep south state of Georgia. It is not a systemically racist country, and it does a couple of things. It causes the police to pull back. It's called the Ferguson effect or the George Floyd effect. Yeah. The police are not engaging in their normal proactive policing. And there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are dead who otherwise wouldn't be dead if the police were doing their normal proactive policing. The other thing it does is you're telling young black men, if you are driving down the street, you see the red lights, why should you comply? Whoever it is in that car is going to try and hurt you. So all these high-profile shootings and killings, virtually all of them, would have been avoided if the suspect/civilian had simply complied. But so you're making things worse.
But isn't it possible that 2 things can be true at once? One, that it is impossible to be the exception to the rule and to be successful, as you have, as Barack Obama, Karen Bass, other people have. But 2, the system itself is systemically racist and creates a situation where it's harder for you to be the exception to the rule.
Well, it's always harder if you don't have a father in the home.
Yeah.
I once had dinner with Tom Sowell, one of my mentors, and he said, if you don't have somebody in your house to make sure you've been fed, clothed, housed, educated, to make sure that you've done your homework and gone to bed on time, you are in trouble. That's the real systemic problem that we're having in America. But there are think tanks on the left, like the Brookings, and on the right, like the American Enterprise Institute, and they give the same formula to escape poverty. Graduate from high school, One, presumably, where you can read, write, and compute at grade level. All too often, that's not happening, which is why I support school choice. Number two, don't have a kid until you're 20. Number three, get married first. Number four, get a job. And number five, avoid the criminal justice system. If you do that, you will not be poor. As we speak, Alex, there are Haitians lining up for a lottery to get into America because America's systemically racist. Nonsense. Nonsense.
Let's talk a little bit about your book, which is available for pre-order now. You break down sort of the behind the scenes of the recall. There's the title right there, As Goes California.
Right.
We were with you for basically every aspect of this. I think I interviewed you more than anybody else on the campaign trail.
You're like Columbo. You're popping up all the time.
Yeah.
So one more question, Larry.
So what are we going to learn in this book that we didn't already know? What was happening behind the scenes that we didn't see?
Well, there are lots of things in the book that are behind the scenes. There's a kind of a little known thing. If you agree to campaign limitations, you can get a little bio put on the little pamphlet that they send out. That's if you expect to raise less than $9 million. If you expect to raise more than that, you have fewer limitations on how you can spend the money. So I was sitting there with all these experienced people, and I said, you know, I've never run for office before, but I've been on radio in every major market for several years. 1.5 million people hear me every day. I think we're going to blow through that $9 million limit, so I don't think we got to restrict ourselves. And they looked at me like I was crazy. Larry, you haven't run before. We have. It's hard to raise that much money. We raised $27 million in 8 weeks, and as a result, once we got past the $9 million or so, there were limitations on how I could spend the money. So that's one of the behind-the-scenes thing that happened. The other thing, you might recall that when the ballot came out, my name wasn't on it. And it turns out there was a law that was passed that was signed, designed basically to get Donald Trump to turn over his taxes. This is before they were turned over or they were exposed, requiring you to turn over 5 years of income taxes. You have to turn them over in two sets. Don't ask me why they need two sets, but they need two sets. We turned it over, and for whatever reason, there were 7 pages missing from the second set. So on that basis, I was declined. And we filed a lawsuit, and we argued a couple things. One, the law didn't apply to a recall, and secondly, the Secretary of State, who's the one who made the decision not to put me on the ballot, could have corrected by looking at the first part to find the 7 pages and putting it on the second part. She chose not to. A 15-minute hearing took place. It was on YouTube, and the judge, who was a Democrat, appointed by a Democrat, up for a judgeship by Gavin Newsom, in 15 minutes, she said, gentlemen, one, I don't believe the recall of this statute applies to the recall, and secondly, the Secretary of State could have complied by simply finding the pages and putting them there, so I'm putting Mr. Elder's name back on the ballot.
Do you have any, like, behind-the-scenes juice or something especially juicy that we didn't know that was happening?
Well, what a grind it was. I mean, I got maybe 4 hours of sleep per day. We, as I mentioned, got in the race with 8 weeks left. We did 100 events. By event, I mean either a print, radio, or TV interview, or a rally, or a fundraiser. It was a 90-mile-an-hour train that we were on.
Yeah, and you also kind of write it as a cautionary tale about California as you're now running for president.
Right.
What do you think is the biggest thing that the nation should learn not to do because of what's happening in California?
Do not have supermajorities of Democrats in both chambers of the legislature the way we do here in California. The Democrats can pass any kind of job-killing legislation that they want, pass any kind of tax hike that they want without a single vote from Republicans, and often they are, which is why people are leaving the state, which is why our average price of a home is 175% above the national average, which is why, in my opinion, our schools are ranked near the bottom, because the Democrats and the teachers union are joined at the hip and they oppose school choice. I can go on and on and on.
Do you think supermajorities are also bad in a place like Tennessee, where they have a supermajority of Republicans?
It depends on the quality of the policies. If you have a supermajority and you pass legislation to set up a panel for reparations, that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
The whole budget is $300 billion. This reparations, $1.2 million for every descendant of slaves, would be $800 billion, 2.5 times our budget. That's just ridiculous and offensive to the people who had nothing whatever to do with slavery, giving money to people who were never slaves.
Obviously, you're not a big fan of Governor Newsom. You ran against him.
Not.
Although I don't think the two of you have ever actually met each other, which
not.
Is also an interesting
thing. Well, one of the
thing.
Reasons we haven't met is because a number of people in the media, hint, hint, did not pressure him to debate me. He was able to avoid debating me.
We offered him that opportunity. We offered you an opportunity to debate your opponents, too.
And if Mr. Newsom had shown up, I would have shown up.
But you can't force somebody to debate, just like we couldn't force you to debate, too. You can extend the invitation. But
the governor of Virginia had to debate his opponent, and you saw what happened.
Do you think that Governor Newsom has a potential to be the president? Even if you disagree with him, do you think he's a good political, you know, has a real shot in the Democratic Party going forward, whether it be this time around or 4 years from now?
I do. I mean, he's a good-looking guy. In fact, you kind of look a little bit like him. He's a good-looking guy. He's smooth. He survived the recall election. He's from the most populous state in the union. He's got a big war chest. Yes, but I think the rest of the country doesn't realize what a loon he is. He's a left-wing California loon, and once the American people realize who he is, I don't think he's electable. But is he nominatable? Yes.
We want to end with something kind of fun. You know, we like to play games here, so we're going to do our game called Personal Issues, where we get to know you as a candidate a little bit more and some of your cultural favorites. All right, you ready?
Cultural favorites.
What is your favorite movie of all time?
No Country for Old Men.
Mm. Who's your favorite athlete of all time?
I think that's got to be Bo Jackson.
He's the best. Mm-hmm. Favorite actor?
Robert Duvall.
Best part of being a Californian?
The weather. No question about it.
Not the taxes. Who's your favorite...
The taxes.
Who's your favorite Democrat, other than your family?
Hubert Humphrey.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What is the favorite way to relax?
Watching a movie with my girlfriend, Nina.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. All right, shout out to Nina.
Did I pass the inspection?
I think you did.
All right,
I'm
good.
Surprised you didn't say that Gloria Allred was your favorite Democrat, who you often debate here on The Issue Is, so we'll have to bring that up the next time we see her.
Our thanks to Larry Elder. Now to our conversation with Brian Tyler Cohen, starting with his conversation with Joe Biden.
We're here today in the White House. Thank you, President Biden, for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you for wanting to speak to me.
Of course. And yet, our agenda has been moving slower.
Here's Brian Tyler Cohen interviewing the President of the United States for his popular podcast and YouTube page. Recently, his YouTube hitting a milestone.
Well, two things.
And that's it. 2 million subscribers. Oh, my God.
2 million subscribers to his YouTube page. His individual videos often receiving millions of views each, among the highest engagement of any progressive online. Brian Tyler Cohen is here. Brian, welcome. Good to see you. By the way, you can stream new episodes of his podcast every week. We want to put up the information on the screen. It is called No Lie with Brian Tyler Cohen. So no lies today. You got to keep it 100.
All right, let's
Brian,
do it.
Welcome back to The Issue. It's good
Thanks
to see you.
Thanks so much
for having me. So let's talk about what you're really good at is this idea of messaging. Clearly, you found a way to connect with millions and millions of people in the digital space. And right now, Joe Biden's got a bit of a messaging problem. His polls show that his favorability is low. There are a lot of concerns about his age, people saying that we shouldn't have a president that's that old. What would your advice be in terms of the messaging for the Democratic Party to overcome some of what are clear weaknesses?
In terms of messaging, I think that initially people get so worried about Joe Biden's age, but this is binary. It's a choice between two people. And if we look at Joe Biden versus whoever the Republican candidate is, again, most likely Donald Trump, it becomes a much clearer race in terms of, you know, not wanting to accept that extremism. And in terms of the messaging that you were alluding to before, I think it's pretty simple. It is that extremism. It's the extremism that Republicans have put forward in the form of abortion bans, LGBT bans, book bans, trying to slash earned benefits like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They put it on full display in 2018, even to a higher degree in 2020, to a higher degree than that in 2022, and they're changing nothing as we head into 2024.
But that's an argument against the other side. What's the argument for Joe Biden? Because don't you want to have a positive message?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if you look at what Joe Biden's been able to accomplish in just 2 years in office, it's the most accomplished presidency that we've seen in our lifetimes. I mean, we're looking at the PACT Act, the CHIPS Act, which has led to an explosion of jobs in this country, the American Rescue Plan, the first gun safety bill in 30 years. We have finally allowed the government to negotiate lower drug prices, record climate investments. We have 12.5 million jobs that have been added, the unemployment rate's at its lowest point in almost 50 years. I mean, that record speaks for itself.
So in terms of the Republican race, because it's getting more crowded now, this week we saw new people entering it, but it sort of starts with Donald Trump, who right now polls show is the leader. And obviously there are a lot of flaws with him electorally, but there's also this incredible strength that he has in terms of a connection with his base that seems unbreakable. The guy is a TV star. He's really good at debates. And he's good at putting his opponents in uncomfortable positions. Is there an argument that Donald Trump may be both the weakest and the strongest Republican nominee?
Absolutely. I think for the same reasons that he's strong is exactly why he's weak. It is that very, you know, it's the his boisterous nature, his whatever, all of that, everything that is Donald Trump that brings all of his supporters to him, which is that, you know, 30% of the electorate that also pushes so many people away.
So in terms of other candidates, Ron DeSantis entering the race this week, you know, his argument would be, I don't have the baggage and the indictments, but I helped you out during COVID. If you're a Republican, you think he did a great job in Florida during COVID. Obviously, Governor Newsom has a different approach here in California. What's the argument against Ron DeSantis?
You have Ron DeSantis, who thus far has refused to display any semblance of strength, right? He refuses to throw even a single punch against Trump. And so if you're trying to differentiate yourself from Trump, and yet you're too afraid to actually do it, then I don't see how you're making that case to any of the voters that I'm going to be the guy that can defeat him, and yet at the same time, I'm too afraid to actually do anything to defeat him.
Another potential candidate hasn't gotten in yet, but probably going to get in soon, is Mike Pence, who we talked to recently, who's clearly got a close connection with the evangelical community, running on his religious conservatism. Does Mike Pence have a shot?
Are you asking if there is a lane for Mike Pence in the Hang Mike Pence party? Or should we throw to those insurrectionists in front of the White House and with a gallows with Mike Pence's face painted on it, yeah, and see what they think about Mike Pence leading the Republican primary?
So you don't think he's got a shot?
I don't think that there is much of a lane for Mike Pence in a party that was very willing to see him assassinated. No.
Let's talk for a moment about you. Can you tell us a little bit about your backstory, how you got into this, and how you built this?
Yeah. Well, I had initially moved to L.A. to act, and did that for a little bit, and didn't exactly seem fulfilling going in for Cars.com commercials and and hawking Cheetos or whatever other brands I was called in for. But was always interested in politics. Organized to bring my whole campus down to the polling places when I was in college for Obama in 2008, started writing some articles for HuffPost, and eventually recognized that I wanted to do video content, and that kind of married the political, you know, love for politics with my interest in being in front of the camera, and started a YouTube channel for nobody, really. I mean, 40 views, 50 views, 100, and just kept at it, kept doing it consistently, and did whatever I thought was right, did what I kind of put on display, what I thought the message needed to be, and it kind of took off from there.
You have just a huge audience at this point, especially among black voters. You have an especially big audience. Why do you think people connect to what you're doing, and what are you doing differently than what everybody else is doing?
Yeah, so I come at this from a different perspective in the sense that I don't have a background in D.C. I've only been to D.C. three times, maybe. One was to interview the president in the White House. So, you know, my background isn't in any of this stuff. And so when I think about this stuff, I think about it in the way that a normal person would, because we both don't have those backgrounds. Me and the rest of, like, regular America don't have these backgrounds where it's just thought of in terms of political terms. So, you know, I think just taking, like, a common sense, no bullshit approach to all of this stuff is kind of like what's been most interesting to people who watch it.
Yeah, and Brian and I are very close, and I remember when you started your podcast and we sort of were talking about that over lunch, and then it ends up with you at the White House interviewing the president. What was that experience like to be brought in as sort of an online guy and to be put face to face with the most powerful person on the planet?
Yeah, it was I think it was the best day of my life. I mean, it was crazy to be there. And I didn't believe it was going to happen until the moment that he walked into the room. And I knew, I mean, my heart was pounding sitting there, because the leader of the, like, you're in the center of the universe when that happens.
Right.
And he walks in, and I was telling myself, I just have to get the first question out and not flub the first question, and then I'll settle into the interview. And able to get the first question out, and we just spoke from there. But one interesting thing was, like, we had 15 minutes, and we had somebody behind him counting me down. And so I was constantly hyper aware of the person in the background, sure, counting me down. And Joe Biden has a tendency to be a little long-winded. And so I remember asking him my first question, and he went on a tangent, and I felt the minutes counting down in my head, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 minutes. And after his first answer was done, we were more than a third of the way through the interview. And I'm just like reshuffling the questions in my mind. But how do you interrupt the president of the United States? You just got it. When he's done talking is when the answer's over.
Yeah.
And so that was the interesting part. But you learn little ways to move the conversation forward and whatnot.
Other than Joe Biden, Who is your favorite guest on the podcast?
Well, I have a great time when Alex Michelson comes on the podcast, because I'll tell you what, it's the one time where you don't get talking points. It is just a fun, normal, casual conversation. So that's my very diplomatic answer there.
Oh, that's smart. I mean, yeah. that doesn't make sense to bring that. No, well, I think I'm your most frequent guest.
Most frequent guest
on the
yeah.
show. We have a great time, so people should check out the No Lie podcast for some of our past conversations. Yeah. And you can see me in a T-shirt. all right. Well, you're now on our show, so we're going to do our personal issues game. This is where we put 30 seconds up on the clock, and we get to know you a little better, because cultural favorites is what you're all about. Okay, so let's start with this, if we can. Brian Tyler Cohen, what is your favorite movie of all time?
Oh, Forrest Gump.
Who is your favorite band or musician?
I'd say Pretty Lights.
Who is your
DJ.
Favorite?
He's a DJ.
Comedian.
Favorite comedian. I don't know if he falls into the comedian category, but I've been an Adam Sandler fan forever. So
yeah, sure. Best way to relax.
Oh man, I'll let you know. I'll let you know when I get there.
Okay. Yeah. Watching a movie, right?
Yeah,
maybe watching
go.
A movie.
We'll go with that.
Yeah.
Our thanks to my pal Brian Tyler Cohen and to Larry Elder and to you for listening. Next week we got a great show. Barbara Lee, the Congresswoman running for United States Senate, will be in studio with us. Also, back to a debate. It's been a minute. Ethan Bierman on the left, Tommy Lahren on the right. That should be a lot of fun next week on The Issue Is. Thanks for listening this week. Please like us and share out our episodes and message me in social media. Let me know what you think. Alex Michelson, ELEX MICHAELSON. Thanks for listening to The Issue Is. See you next week.